All right. Good evening. This is Dan Miller, the author of No More Mondays. Again, thank you for being part of this whole process. It's exciting to launch a book, and we're delighted to have each of you be a part of that. And trust that in being a part, you'll get hope and encouragement and a little bit of new insight, perhaps, to take you to new levels of success in your own lives. I'm going to be going through the 12 chapters, and the 12 chapters in No More Mondays. If I spend 4 minutes each on those, that's going to give us 48 minutes. So that's about what I'm going to allot on each chapter, just going through and giving you some of the basic concepts, sharing some of the most popular stories, perhaps, that are in there as we have time. So I'm going to go right into that. This is the overview of No More Mondays. Chapter 1, the title is Don't Be Stupid. Now, that's a title that has gotten us a lot of attention already because it sounds pretty controversial, but it comes out of some information that Adam Smith wrote about way back in 1776 when he wrote Wealth of Nations, a highly influential business book, remains to be so to this day. And he talked in there about people who spend their life performing the same repetitive task. And he said, if you were performing a repetitive task, now keep in mind this was 1776 when he wrote this, he said, if you're performing a repetitive task over and over again, that person generally becomes as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become. Now, I know that sounds pretty harsh, and we don't need to just spend a lot of time there, but the question is, when we are in the kind of changing environment that we have today, you need to be careful about being in something that is just repetitive and predictable. For one thing, those are the kind of jobs that are most easily sent overseas, outsourced, all those terms that we're hearing. Those are the ones that are easiest to do that, where we can just have somebody else stand there and do the same repetitive thing. Now, we also know just from real experience, and believe me, a lot of what I write about in No More Mondays may sound like it's pretty controversial in some ways relative to the common job models, and it is. I'm not criticizing anybody for having any particular kind of job, but I want you to realize that whatever it is that you're doing, you have a choice. What I do want to do is challenge anybody's thinking that they're trapped, that they have no alternatives. So a lot of what I have in No More Mondays is simply to help you see the new opportunities, see how the workplace is changing, and how you can take advantage of those changes rather than feeling victimized by them. Now, in Chapter 1, then, so I talk about the changing work models. And there's a basic concept that I touch on in Chapter 1 where I distinguish between vocation, career, and job. Those are three terms we tend to kind of throw around and use them interchangeably, and yet they're very different concepts. Vocation is the big picture, and that should include your purpose, your mission, your destiny, your calling. Those are all things that are part of your vocation. That's the big picture. So if you want to help make the world a better place, or you want to help reduce pain and suffering in the world, whatever, those would be concepts that would be part of a worthy calling or vocation. Career, then, is a subset of that. So if that, in fact, were your calling as a career, you could be a physician, a pathologist, a pastor, teacher, politician. We could go on and on with the things that would fully embrace your vocation in multiple careers. Job, then, is the smallest component. Job is what you do daily. That's what creates a paycheck. But if you frame it in this way, you see how it takes the emphasis off the daily job. Jobs will come and go. We can't control that. People are calling us every day, letting us know about jobs that they're losing. Today, as you know, there was an announcement that Ford is going to offer 54,000 workers the opportunity to leave the premises. Now, that's a dramatic kind of change for those people who may have never experienced anything else. But that happens. But if you, as a No More Mondays reader, can understand the concept of your purpose or calling, it takes the pressure off what you do in a daily job. Yes, it's important, but if jobs come and jobs go, whether it's by your own choosing or circumstantial, that should never change your calling. That stays the same. That's how you get a sense of continuity, so that even as things change, you know that you are on the right track. Now, that kind of leads us into Chapter 2. Chapter 2 is titled, Let Your Life Speak. And that comes from an old Quaker phrase. Many of you know I was raised in the Mennonite community, Mennonite Amish, and we had Quaker friends who were somewhat similar to us. And the Quakers have a saying that is that, let your life speak. Matter of fact, at one point, I thought about titling this book that. There is another book written by a Quaker that is titled that. It's a wonderful book, but we chose it for a chapter in here. The sense that what we do is important. What we do Monday through Friday says a lot about who we are, what our values are, what we consider important. And so we want you to grasp that concept. Let your life speak. I believe each of us does have a calling. Each of us has a life message. We've seen more and more how many people are concerned about that. Books like Purpose Driven Life, with the dramatic sales of that, book by Rick Warren, people are saying, you know, it's not enough just to make a paycheck. I want to know that my life is making a difference. We see that in the younger generation, the Gen X coming up, where they're saying, you know, I don't really care about having a $500,000 house and 2 Mercedes in the driveway. I want to make a difference. I want to know that I've done something important. I want to do something noble. We hear those kind of comments more and more, and not just by people who are at the retirement age, but people who are just coming into the workforce, and thus we've seen an explosion of green businesses, or what I call social entrepreneurs, where people want to make a difference, but they may do it in a business environment where there's still a profit to be made, books need to make sense, they aren't dependent on other people to donate money, but they really want to make a difference in their business anyway. I was reading just today an article about venture capitalists who have always been seen as money-hungry and greedy, but there are some very significant venture capitalist funds available at this point that are looking for businesses in which to invest where they have a social focus, where they want to make a difference, not just drive big profits to the investors. So there are a lot of things that are happening that are pretty interesting in that category. Chapter 3 is titled, Who's Making Your Lunch Today? And I start that chapter off with a cute little story about Charlie Brown in one of the Peanuts cartoons, where Charlie Brown complains to Linus that every day his lunch is the same. And when Linus asks Charlie Brown who makes his lunch, Charlie Brown says, I do. And see, and then the next paragraph, it says, when it comes to the activities of our lives, most of us do make our own lunches. So while there may be some comfort in sameness if you want different results, you must do something different. So this one talks about personal responsibility. You know, don't allow circumstances to control the decisions that you're making in your life. You need to take responsibility. People who look for someone else to blame are always going to end up feeling like victims of circumstances. And you don't want to put yourself in that category. As soon as you accept responsibility for where you are, what your life consists of today, you put yourself in the driver's seat and you'll begin to see new possibilities pop up all around you. You know, and you don't need to wait on perfect conditions for success to happen. Just go ahead and do something. Now, there are a couple stories in this chapter that I refer to that people comment about a lot. One is about Monty Roberts, who is known as the Horse Whisperer. And the title of the little vignette in Chapter 3 that refers to Monty Roberts is titled, You Keep Your F, I'm Keeping My Dream. When Monty Roberts was in high school, his teacher asked the class to write about what they wanted to do when they grew up. And Monty wrote that he wanted to own a ranch and raise thoroughbred racehorses. His teacher gave him an F and explained that the dream was unrealistic for a boy living in a camper in the back of a pickup truck. He would never be able to make this a reality. When the teacher offered the chance to rewrite his paper for a higher grade, Monty told him, You keep your F, I'm keeping my dream. Just a great story about somebody who did not allow circumstances or other people's expectations or lack of expectations control what he decided to do. There's another story in there that I've been asked about on interviews all this week already, and that's about Jim Carrey. There's a story, Jim Carrey, the actor, grew up extremely poor for a time. His family was living in a Volkswagen van on a relative's lawn, literally. But he believed in his future. He sent his resume into the Carol Burnett Show when he was 10 years old because he had that clear vision of what he was going to be doing. And then there's that famous story that I ran across where he, sitting up on a hillside overlooking Los Angeles, wrote himself a check for $10 million for services rendered, folded it up, put it in his pocket. Now, this is one of those things that I happen to be a big believer in terms of setting the stage for what becomes your reality. I mean, even in the Bible, we're told, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And we see these things being played out in successful people's lives time and time again. So Jim Carrey wrote a check to himself. Now, we have nothing but a piece of paper. It had no value. But he wrote it out, so he actually saw it. Jim Carrey, $10 million for services rendered, and put that into his wallet. Well, as we say, the rest is history. It wasn't too many years later where he then had Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. He had The Mask. And one of the ones that I is my personal favorites, I guess, Liar, Liar. And his per-film fee had escalated to $20 million. So he bypassed that. I mean, one of the things, and I don't even remember if I've got this in No More Mondays. I may not. But when I went through a particularly tough business crash back in 1988, one of the things that I did during that period of time was when vendors were all around us, the IRS took our home, our cars, and we had nothing. I was in a borrowed car, took a commission sales job to go back out on the road and just try to generate some income to keep food on the table for our family. But I had a $100 bill that I would keep in my wallet and just keep it there. Now, that allowed me, no matter how rough things got, I knew that was there. If we really were in a jam, you know, I could go to that. But it created a mindset for me that I always realized, no matter how things bad things were, if I was walking on through the soles of my shoes, I had that $100 bill there. And I think it helped me create a mindset for seeing myself differently than what the circumstances would have allowed me to see myself at that particular time. But I've kept that there. There have been a lot of times I use that at this point just when there are situations that arise when I'm having lunch with somebody who's having a tough time or whatever. I've given that $100 bill away many times and replaced it, so it's come to serve that kind of purpose. But I still, to this day, no matter what I have in terms of cash in my pocket, I always have that $100 bill folded up in my wallet. And I encourage you just to look for those kind of things to help you set your expectations high, even if circumstances are discouraging in terms of what's happening right now. Chapter 4 in No More Mondays is titled Don't Wait for the Wizard. Now, this is taken from that conclusion of the classic movie The Wizard of Oz, where those characters discovered, you know, you remember Dorothy, the Cowardly Lion, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow. Those characters discovered that the abilities and attributes they'd spent so much time searching for were things they already possessed. Just a great image there of what I see people going through. You know, when I meet with people, I mean, I don't have extraordinary kind of ideas or insight or brilliance or intelligence. I help the people look at things that are already there, help them see things they may have just been overlooked looking. You know, sometimes we're too close to things. We don't recognize what's right in front of us. But I think that for most of us, the seeds of greatness, the tools that we need to go on to extraordinary success in our lives really are right there in front of us. Now, there's a spiritual principle in this as well. I mean, you all know that my writing has a strong spiritual framework to it, and I love to look at the lessons that we can learn from real-life situations. But there's a, in this chapter, in chapter 4, I talk about the fact that inasmuch as you don't wait for the wizard to give you something magical, in the same way, it's unrealistic to just expect God to plop down success in your lap. He gives us the tools to work with, but we have to do something with those. The story of the talents in the Bible and many others certainly lend itself to that, that let us know our part is required in this. I have in this chapter an old Jewish prayer that they used to recite at Passover that says this: "Blessed are you, Lord, God of all creation. Through your goodness we have this bread to offer, which earth has given and human hands have made. It will become for us the bread of life." Now that prayer has in it a pretty profound spiritual principle. Now, God's gift to us are raw materials. They're not finished products. Now if you think about the most revered sacrament in the church, you know, being Holy Communion, now, does God give us bread and wine? Why wouldn't God give us something that we could just pick up and use for that precious part of a service, communion? No, he doesn't give us bread and wine. Where do you find those in nature? You can't. See, God makes wheat. He doesn't make bread. He makes grapes, not wine. But when we take those raw materials that God gives us, we add our work, and then they become something special. That's the way it works. Now, another concept in chapter 4 that I want to just touch on a little bit is that of risk. This, again, in doing a whole lot of radio interviews already for No More Mondays, radio and TV, it comes up repeatedly. People ask about risk. Well, isn't it risky to move out of a traditional job? Isn't it risky to move out of a job that I've had for 23 years or 30 years or whatever it happens to be? We have to realize what risk really means. See, risk implies that you have no control. So if you go to Las Vegas and you put the deed to your house down on a roll of the dice, that's risky. You have no control. It's just chance. That's risky. If you leave a job and say, well, I'm going to see what happens, that's risky. If you pick up the paper and you respond to a business opportunity that you haven't researched and you send in your $1,200 or whatever for that, that's risky. If you buy a Subway franchise, the hottest selling franchise there is, without really doing research and creating a careful plan, that's risky. However, the counterpart to that lets us know if you create a careful plan of action, we dramatically reduce risk. So the kind of things that I see people moving into effectively where they go to much higher levels of success are not risky. They're things where people have decided to seize an opportunity. And that's terminology I'd like you to think about instead of risk. Seize the opportunity, and they move to higher levels of success because they have carefully looked at themselves, they've researched the idea, they've created a plan of action, and they transition into that. That, to me, is not a risky proposition. That's a very healthy, mature proposition to simply move into a higher level of success. In many ways, and I don't want to play this out, overplay this, but to me, when I look at the current work environment, when we look at those 54,000 people who have been working for Ford Motor Company, did they think they were secure? Well, of course they did. Everybody has told us, get a job with a big company where they give you a paycheck, a 401k, medical benefits, that's security. And all of a sudden, it vanished. Those people are in a position where one person can walk in and eliminate their job today. And that's true for many traditional kind of positions around the country as we speak. If you have a hot dog stand and you're out here in the corner and you're selling hot dogs and you have 763 people come by every day and buy a hot dog, you have to have 763 people decide they don't want to do business with you anymore to put you out of work. That's a different kind of situation, totally. And to me, implies less risk than in a situation where one person can put you on the street. Now, let me give you another example of how we're seeing these changing work models. My accountant just left here just a few minutes ago. She comes out here Tuesday and Thursday afternoons. Now, I'm not a big enough company to justify having a full-time accountant. She, several years ago, recognized the vulnerability of being employed by one company, how many people were losing their positions. She decided to take her skills as a competent accountant and find 8 or 10 businesses that were not large enough to have a full-time accountant but could use her services maybe one day a week or 2 or 3 days a month. That's what she's done. In doing that, she gave herself time flexibility. She doubled her income because what she charges hourly is certainly more than she was being paid hourly as a full-time employee, and she dramatically increased her security. If she has 8 companies for which she's providing services, and if she loses one of those, then she has to replace that one and still has 7 that are functioning, as opposed to being a captive employee of one company where if she loses them, she's lost 100% of her business. That's an example of what we're seeing in the kind of subtle shift in work environments, subtle shift in work models, where it's not totally turning people into. Now, she is not what I would call an entrepreneur. She's certainly not a Donald Trump, a Ted Turner. She would hardly even describe herself as being in business for herself, but she's just tweaked the work model a little bit so that it works for her benefit. Chapter 5 in No More Mondays, titled Donald's Not Coming, Fire Yourself. Now, there's a story in there that I use. I start out, it's the old frog in the kettle story. It doesn't matter if it's literally true or not or if it's scientific. The principle is simply this. If you put a frog in hot water, he'll jump out. If you put a frog in lukewarm water and slowly turn up the heat, they say he'll sit there and cook to death. Again, true or not, it makes a great analogy for what I see happen to a lot of people in the workplace. The changes have been subtle. They haven't been dramatic. It hasn't been overnight. They've been just subtle changes. But in those subtle changes, the entire work environment has changed, and the person hasn't done anything to respond, and they're in a much different place and a much more vulnerable place today than what they were when they started years ago. So the question then that I pose in this chapter is, why don't you fire yourself? Now, I don't mean to do that literally. You don't need to change anything. I'm not suggesting that you quit your job. Just imagine that you were not working anywhere. You know, then ask yourself, would you hire yourself for the same position that you have now? Would you go back to the same job that you currently have? If so, that's wonderful. And believe me, you know, there are lots of people who are reading No More Mondays who will find confirmation for what they're doing now. I mean, we are getting invitations to go into corporations with this message. Now, if corporations thought that everybody there was going to quit and walk out the door, I would not be welcome there. But that's not what happens. For a lot of people, it may for the first time really help them see there were a lot of good reasons for me having chosen this. I need to be here. This is a good fit for me, and we want that to be true. I mean, we're teaching these principles in some interesting company settings now where the company owners know that it'll help them help people make horizontal changes, where it may be just a subtle readjustment, a realignment to make a person have a better fit for what they're doing. And ultimately, company owners know as well that if there really is a mismatch or somebody is underemployed at this point, nobody wins by having them stay there. Allow them to move on, and companies are seeing that and being willing to do that. So fire yourself, and then ask yourself, would you hire yourself again for the exact same position that you have? Now, one of the terms that's used in this chapter, again, that seems to grab people is human filing cabinets. That's a term I ran across a couple years ago, but it was in reference to office building, human filing cabinets. Now, that's not an environment that I find very appealing. And what we're seeing in this shift in work environments, you know, we're not seeing that there's no jobs anywhere, nobody can find any work. We're not seeing that at all. Things are just changing. And one of the things that's changing are those kind of environments that put people in the cubicles where they feel like they're, you know, cattle being fed, getting ready for slaughter. I mean, we know that that's tough. Now, there are companies that I go in and out of all the time where they have soft lighting, they have music, they have flowers, they're doing things with colors to try to soften that environment, and those are admirable things to do. Certainly, I commend them on that, and we hope that we can make those environments better. But you have to realize, again, there are a lot of choices to be made, and if that's an environment that is not appealing, don't think that you're trapped there. Just identify what would be the ideal, what would be the perfect day for you, and as you get clearer and clearer on that, then it becomes much easier to actually make that a reality. One of the things that I responded to a question earlier today had to do with the person knew they were miserable where they were, and his question was, you know, should I leave? Well, my response is no. It's easy to determine what you're moving from, but don't do that until you identify what you're moving to. See, what you're moving from, when I hear people talk about resentment, anger, frustration, despair, discouragement, guilt, depression, all those horrible emotional components, I know that they're looking at what has already happened. They're looking at the past. Things aren't fair. I was mistreated. I hate where I am. I've never liked it or whatever. But as soon as that person starts to become clear on what they're moving to, then we see an explosion of confidence, enthusiasm, boldness, and those negative emotions start to diminish. So get clear on what you're going to. I'm not one to recommend burning bridges. I'm recommending get clear on what you're moving to, then create a transition if, in fact, that does indicate changing what you're currently doing. Another concept that I develop in this particular chapter, in Chapter 5, is that of distributed workers. Now, you know from the term what that means. That means there are a whole lot of people. I mean, statistics show us that about 28.7 million people at this point telecommute. They don't go to an office anywhere. 28.7 million. They're working for companies. They're working for traditional companies, but they're what we call distributed workers. That has been an absolutely exploding phenomenon, and more companies are jumping on the bandwagon. They're discovering they save millions of dollars in transportation fees, in real estate fees, having people come into an office. If we're doing work that involves knowledge work rather than production work anyway, why does a person have to come into a 13-story building to do that when they have their computer in the spare room at their house? Why not allow them to do it there? So that's one of the models that companies are more and more receptive to, and as you're looking for new opportunities, you can easily suggest that and find that companies may be more and more receptive to that. Now, I'm going to go on to Chapter 6. Chapter 6 is titled Secure or Imprisoned. And I start off Chapter 6 with a story by Charles Dickens where he talks about a man who had been in prison for many years. And, you know, naturally this man longed for freedom from his dungeon of despair and hopelessness. We would expect that from anybody in prison. Finally, the day of his liberation arrived. He was led from his gloomy cell into the bright and beautiful world. He momentarily gazed into the sunlight, then turned and walked back to his cell. He had become so comfortable with confinement that the thought of freedom was overwhelming. For him, the chains and darkness were a predictable security. Now, that is a phenomenon that I see played out. And as a career and life coach, I see that played out a lot, where people, even realizing there are better opportunities, choose to stay in what I call comfortable misery, where the predictability of what they have is at least better than the unpredictability of moving into something new. Now, this has a lot to do with personality style. I mean, we are all created differently, and I acknowledge that and embrace that. For some, the idea of change is terrifying, whereas for others, it's very invigorating and exciting. I'm not one to just say you've got to change what you're doing, but if we come back to you're miserable, you have to realize that you have choices, many choices, that you can act upon. So if you choose to stay in the environment, then realize it was a choice. It's a choice of yours. And if you choose that, then hold your head high and do it with excellence. But in giving options for something better, be careful about then complaining that things have not changed, because you do have the ability to make those changes. Now, in this chapter, I go through what I call the five predictors of success. And those, let me just run through those just real quickly here, because they're pretty important to understand. The five predictors of success that I outline in chapter five, actually, I'm sorry, in chapter six, are number one, passion. Number two, determination. Number three is talent. Number four is self-discipline, and number five is faith. Now, I don't have time to go into those in more depth, but you can ask yourself, and you've got your copy of No More Mondays, ask yourself if you have those characteristics. If you don't, what could you do to increase one of those or each of those in your life? Those are things that can be learned, can be grown. Those aren't things that... Don't take the Popeye mentality on any of this. You know, I am what I am. I can't change. Sure you can. I mean, we can change dramatically. We can change things if it's important to us. I mean, one of the things that I lay out repeatedly in No More Mondays is the fact that this is an ongoing process. It's unrealistic to expect an 18-year-old to make the right career choice and then stay with it for 40 years. It's just totally unrealistic. The workplaces change. That person changes. You're a different person at 35 or 55 than you were at 20 years old. Expect to gain from that difference, from the increased knowledge, maturity, wisdom, all those things. Expect to benefit from those. Don't try to keep things the same. It'll work against you. You know, late Peter Drucker, who was a great writer and thinker, is said, if you're doing things the same way today that you were doing them a year ago, you're probably falling behind and making yourself vulnerable. So be careful of just trying to force things to stay the same. Even if you're not naturally drawn to change, just recognize that's part of the world that we live in, and the more you understand it, the less you'll feel victimized by it, the more you can take advantage of it. Now, one of the things that I look for in anybody's situation is multiple solutions. It's very easy to come up with two or three obvious solutions to any situation. And this is one of the principles that I developed in Chapter 6. Look for multiple situations. Don't assume too quickly that there are only two or even three possibilities. Here's an example. If you dislike your boss, all right, you could quit your job. You know, you could quit your job or stay there and quit your complaining. Well, those are two options, but there's certainly a lot of others. You could ask for a transfer. You could learn ways to love your boss. You could buy the company and fire your boss. You could join the Marines. You could go back to school. You could marry the boss's daughter or son. You could praise the boss's work to facilitate a promotion for him or her. Or you could volunteer for a demotion, but to take you to a different position. I mean, just get creative in what you see as the possibilities. And I give some really interesting anecdotes and stories in this chapter, chapter 6, that kind of play that out. There's one about a gentleman's daughter who was confronted with having to marry the town wizard, in essence, and what she did to create another option other than the two obvious ones that you would expect. Now, chapter 7 is titled, But You Owe Me. And in this, I break out these distinctions between time and effort versus results. Now, this is a very important distinction, and if you understand this, you'll understand a lot of what the message of No More Mondays is, because this is a critical distinction in understanding how the workplace is changing. We are in an economy that embraces paying people for their time. Where you put in 8 hours, you expect to be paid for 8 hours. No matter what work you did, no matter if it was excellent work or if it was poor work. I mean, this is one of the things that I hear a lot from teachers. They say, I'm paid exactly the same if I do a great job or if I do a lousy job. Well, that's not a good model, and I agree readily that that is not a good model. What we want is to move away from that. Now, we have to understand how recent this whole concept of being paid for your time is. It's a pretty recent phenomenon to be paid for your time. It only goes back to about where Henry Ford began the assembly line, and he decided that he was going to pay people. It started out at $2.50 a day he was going to pay people. Then he increased that to $5 a day, and here's why. He said, this is going to be pretty mindless work to have people just stand here and put these parts together like we're going to have them do. But if we pay them $5 a day, they'll do it regardless. Well, he was exactly right, and people did. So he would have them stand there, and that was the beginning of the American assembly lines. He would have them just stand there and be paid for their time. What happened is because of that, we moved into a whole new era of how people expected to be compensated. So they expected if they put in 40 hours, they should be paid for 40 hours. If they put in 50, they should be paid 40 hours regular and 10 hours overtime. But now realize how that defies common sense in some ways. If you came to me 100 years ago and said, Dan, I want you to build me a wagon, I would not have, you would not have guaranteed me $20 an hour or $45,000 a year. We simply would have agreed on a price for the wagon. The time that it took me to make the wagon would be entirely up to me, and you would pay me upon completion. That's paying for results, and that's a very healthy model. And guess what? We're now seeing a return to that very kind of model. That's all we're seeing. Now, it can be intimidating for people to realize that's the way that we're changing, but companies are saying, you know what, we are not going to guarantee X number of dollars for so many hours. We're simply going to pay for results. Now, that means that they can then allow people to work from home. They can allow people to show up at 10 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock. They can leave at 4 o'clock instead of 6, because all of a sudden we're moving into paying for results instead of time. That's what's opening up a whole new segment of opportunities in our work environment as well. And if you understand that, if you're willing to be paid for results rather than time, it opens up a world of new opportunities for you. Now, that's a major point. That's in Chapter 7. That's a major point in what we're going to see. Now, let me just add this, just as kind of a one last point from this chapter. We are rapidly moving toward the time, and this is not just speculation. This is according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. We are rapidly moving toward the time when only 50% of the American workforce will be employees. Now, I said 50% of the American workforce. I'm not saying 50% are going to be out of work. That's not true. We have lots of opportunities. Only 50% will be employees. The rest are going to be contingency workers, independent contractors, electronic immigrants, temps, entrepreneurs, and all those terms that we're hearing. And you have to realize that in today's environment, the employee model is a diminishing model. The model where somebody pays you a guaranteed pay for your time with those benefits, that is a diminishing model. The model that's exploding are those things that are not traditional employees, where there is more focus on paying for results. Now, that should not be seen as intimidating if you understand, if you take responsibility for being compensated for your results. Now, there's a whole lot of questions that I get around this issue. You know, how do you pay a receptionist for results, or how do you pay a nurse for results, or how do you pay a teacher for results? I mean, those are reasonable questions. But in most environments, most of the positions can be equated in some way to results. And just recognize if your position, your talents don't fit into that category, you know, then that's fine. I mean, we're not going to see hourly pay go away in its entirety, but you have to realize if you are looking for a position currently and having a struggle in finding a position where they give you a guaranteed salary, a company car, 401k benefits, medical and dental, you may be just looking into a narrow segment of where the real opportunities are. You may be overlooking 50% of the opportunities that are right in front of you if you just simply look at a subtle change in work models. Now, that's one I could go on indefinitely for, but we're going to move on. Chapter 8, then, is finding work that fits. Finding work that fits. How do you do that? What do you do when you start looking at these new work models? How can you find work that fits? I have listed in this chapter 10 different work models. I'm just going to just touch on them just briefly, but they are different work models, and you need to be aware that they are available when you are considering what is the best fit for you. So we have a traditional employee position where you show up at 7:30 and punch out at 4:30, 2 weeks vacation, hour for lunch, 401k. I mean, we all understand that. That is simply one opportunity. You could do freelance work. Now, we hear about this. We think, well, what could I do? But there are a great number of positions, skill sets. If you are a bookkeeper, graphic designer, computer programmer, you know, trainer, we can go on and on and on. Any of those things would translate easily into doing freelance work. Let me give you another example. I worked with a lady who had been a human resource director in a major company, and her husband spends a lot of time out of the country. She wanted to be able to have more time freedom, spend time with her horses, but she didn't want to just unplug. Here's what we had her do. I hooked her up with I gave her 8 or 10 different names of training companies, companies like Paget Thompson, SkillPath, Career Track, all these different companies that provide one-day seminars. You see the flyers come through, and they book a hotel room somewhere, fill the hotel room, and somebody walks in and does a presentation. She was an excellent candidate because of her background in human resources to do those presentations. She put out the words of those and immediately got picked up by a couple of those where she's paid roughly $2,000 a day to walk in and do a presentation for one of their seminars. So she books 2 or 3 of those a month. In addition, she is an adjunct professor for 2 different major universities, but she never goes to campus. Her classes are totally online. She sits in her house with her cowboy boots and blue jeans. She teaches classes. She has office hours for her students to ask her questions, but she does it all from her home. So now she leaves her house 2 or 3 days a month to go teach seminars using her background as a human resource director for the presentations that she does, and then she does adjunct teaching. Now, she works, her description of this, she works about a third of the time that she did previously, about a third of the hours she puts in, and she has more than doubled her income. Now, that's an example, again, of just that subtle move. She's not, again, some entrepreneur. She doesn't have a new business where she's going to have 20 employees. She's never going to have any employees. She doesn't want that. But she just took her skills and packaged them in a way that gave her exactly what she was looking for, continued and actually increased income, but more time flexibility and not having to dress up in a business suit and go off to fight the traffic into the office every day. Now, there's 10 models listed in here. We've got the traditional work, freelance work. We've got selling, consulting. I go through all of these in here. You could look at franchising. We know that's a model that has exploded in popularity where they've already created a prototype for how this works, and you simply reproduce that. You pay a fee, but you get ongoing help from them in running the business. So their phrase, franchising, is you're in business for yourself but not by yourself, and that's a model. Distributorships, you can do licensing, you can look at business opportunities, you can provide a personal service. You can simply, I mean, we have a massage therapist who comes to our house every Friday and gives massages to Joanne and me. I mean, she doesn't have an office. She doesn't have a location. She brings her table. She sits up here. It's a wonderful service that meets our needs and certainly has allowed her to have a very successful business of her own. And then number 10 is simply what I call I never thought of that work. There are so many unusual things that people are doing today that really translate into meaningful, fulfilling, and profitable work that people would not even imagine were possible. And one of the examples I have in this chapter is that Chuck realized that as a local apparel salesman, he was a fabric salesman, and he recognized that if there was a flaw in the fabric, they were selling that entire roll of fabric at just pennies on the dollar. He started buying that. He and his wife would cut that fabric into squares and sell it as rags, sold it as rags to body shops and new car dealerships, places like that. It wasn't long into it. He got a contract with Dollar General to supply those rags packaged in just a colorful plastic bag. In the first year, he and his wife netted over $150,000. Got a lot of stories in there about those kind of things that people have done to create significant income for themselves. Now, number 9 is one place forever, blessing or curse. Now, is it a blessing or a curse to stay in one place for a long period of time? And we put a lot of emphasis on loyalty and certainly to be commended, being loyal. But we have to recognize that in today's environment, sometimes what we confuse as loyalty is simply camouflaging the fact that we're falling behind in recognizing where opportunities are and then making ourselves more and more vulnerable. That we don't want to do. Just realize that some change is good. Change is inevitable to start with. We don't have any choice about whether or not to stop change. We simply can decide how are we going to respond to that. Chapter 10 I've got titled Throw Out Your TV and Your Alarm Clock Too. And what I want you to realize is that there is time. People often ask me, Dan, how do you have the time to do the things that you do? You know, teleseminars, creating new products, CDs, e-books, manuscripts, and so on. And I just simply tell them we have 168 hours in a week. That's all we have. I encourage you to do what I call a zero-based time budget, where you take the 168 hours you've got and determine how are you using that? What are you doing with that time? Because I find that there is time when people sit in front of the TV or do things that are not very productive, and I'm probably doing something else. And it's in those periods of time where I can create new things that have a dramatic effect on my financial income and the satisfaction as I go along. Now, again, this is not to just make yourself a hard taskmaster and never relax. I spend lots of time with family and doing fun things. Joanna and I travel extensively. So it's not that I've just eliminated everything but work. That's not it at all. But if you want to make a transition, even if you maintain what you're doing, if you can find 4 or 5 hours a week, you will absolutely transform what your options are in a 90-day period. That's how quickly you can become an expert in something, create a plan, and start producing significant income. 90 days if you spend 4 to 5 hours doing that. What part of what I cover in Chapter 10, you don't have to create something. You don't have to patent something. You don't have to reinvent something. All you need to do to be extremely successful is to do something 10% better or provide added value. You can take an ordinary idea, just do it a little bit better, and you'll be amazed at how people will respond to that and reward you for that. Chapter 11, No Money, No Problem. The question is, you know, is it really possible to make a lot of money without working for a big company? Well, sure it is. I mean, just think through the logic of that. For a company to bring you on as an employee, your efforts need to generate 3 to 5 times what they're going to pay you. Now, obviously, if your efforts generate $41,000 for a company, they're not going to pay you $40,000. That would be poor business on their part. Your efforts need to generate 3 to 5 times. That's why I repeatedly see people who are making $15 an hour as a graphic designer or in accounting or something like that, and they move out on their own, well, a reasonable fee for those services is going to be perhaps $40 to $60 an hour. So they triple or quadruple their hourly income, and it just makes sense if you just do the math on that. Theoretically, you ought to be able to leave a position as an employee, do the same work on your own, work fewer hours, and immediately increase your income. So now, again, I'm not providing just quick, easy solutions. You have to work through how that would really take place. But believe me, you know, that is what I've seen played out hundreds and hundreds of times. Now, another thing is people say, well, I could never do something on my own. I don't have $300,000. I can't go to the bank and borrow a small business loan. Well, you may not need to. I have some statistics in Chapter 11 about what capital it takes to put legs on ideas, especially in today's environment where we have ideas that utilize information, service, technology, where we're not talking about bricks and mortar businesses. If you want to start a restaurant or a service station or a hardware store or a bowling alley, yes, you better be looking at $400,000 because you've got a very traditional bricks and mortar business. But we've got people today starting businesses where there's no capital required at all, and they go on to make that $150,000 the first year. Lots of ideas require no capital. Statistically, we're told 26% of all businesses being started today require no capital. 69% require less than $10,000. That should be pretty encouraging. Not having money is not a roadblock. It's not an obstacle for being able to start a business. I've got in there a listing of how people become wealthy, what it is they do that creates wealth for them. 74% of the people in America who end up wealthy are business owners. 10% are senior executives. 5% are salespeople or consultants. Fewer than 1% are stockbrokers, inventors, investors, actors, directors, authors, songwriters, all those. Fewer than 1%. Now, keep that clearly in mind. I mean, we all know the little kid who wants to be, you know, the next Michael Jordan or the next Tiger Woods. The chances of that happening are infinitesimally small. Now, if you have that talent, absolutely pursue that. But that's the 1% category. You can put yourself in the 74% category of how people get wealthy this afternoon if you go out and buy a lawnmower and start mowing yards tomorrow. So I lay that out. How is it that people really get wealthy, and help you see how that is accomplished? Well, Chapter 12 is titled Living with Passion, Purpose, and Profit. You know, what is it that you really want to do? What is it that you're doing that provides value? Decide again, what's your ideal day would look like? How would you spend your time? What skills would you use? And keep in mind, you know, in as much as we all do want money and probably more of it, and that's okay. I mean, wanting more money is simply asking for a way to provide more service for people. If you're doing something legitimate, and certainly I wouldn't expect you to do that, the only way you get money is providing more service for people. It's not being greedy, selfish, self-centered. It's providing more service. If you figure out a way to provide more service to people, money is going to show up unexpectedly. So there has to be more than just the money. There has to be that sense of meaning and accomplishment, and then the money will show up unexpectedly. Well, I'm going to end with this. I'm going to actually end with a poem that I have at the very end of Chapter 12 in No More Mondays. And it's titled, How to Change the World. And this really kind of captures the essence of how we approach this. And the basic concept is you can change yourself. You may not be able to control circumstances, the economy, and all those things we see happening around us, but you can decide what you want your life to accomplish and what steps you're going to take to make that happen. Here's the poem. This comes from an inscription written on a tomb dated 1100 A.D. of an Anglican bishop, and this is in Westminster Abbey, which is in London. When I was young and free and my imagination had no limits, I dreamed of changing the world. As I grew older and wiser, I discovered the world would not change. So I shortened my sights somewhat and decided to change only my country, but it too seemed immovable. As I grew into my twilight years, in one last desperate attempt, I settled for changing only my family, those closest to me, but alas, they would have none of it. And now I realize as I lie on my deathbed, if I had only changed myself first, then by example I might have changed my family. From their inspiration and encouragement, I would then have been able to better my country. And who knows, I might have even changed the world. That's a quick overview of the basic concepts in No More Monday. Again, I'm Dan Miller, author of No More Mondays.